Welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders. Today, I'm really excited to have with us Rebecca Pang, who is currently the Vice President of Treasury Solutions at a Canadian bank. Currently, she's based in Toronto, Canada, and very excited to have her share with us her journey. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much. Great to have me here today.
Thank you. Maybe let us kick off with the very first question. And I would love to find out and share with our listeners what inspired your journey into the financial services space, and more specifically, your current focus on treasury solutions and also strategic business development.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the bank, that the role they play in the society, and also in connecting business that require capital versus investor that can offer capital. And I think my career in banking is really built by the dynamic intersection. I've done strategy as a management consultant early in my career, and merger and acquisition, and now getting into payment, which I will touch on later. Yeah. So I think it's really the constant pursuit of trying to understand the intricate dance between numbers and strategy that fuel my passion. As I mentioned, you know, I've done M&A for a couple of years, so it's really crafting impactful strategy that actually lead to some of the inorganic or complex M&A to execute those growth opportunities. So all of those steps are great learning experience. Now back to payment. I think payment, as we look today, is really looking at how we can shape the next generation innovative payment that fits the evolving needs of our client. And my focus is all more on the commercial banking side, which I know in the payment world, retail payment, you know, you and I use a lot of fintech and payment app. But in the commercial banking side, you know, for business owner, there's still a huge opportunity for payment innovation. And when you think about it, for any business owner, whether you run large corporation or small business owner, one man show, payment is just the lifeblood and at the core of the commerce, right? Like, you know, you got to pay your vendor, you're going to receive payment from your customer, and you want to do all of those on a timely basis with accuracy, speed, and ease. And more importantly, with all the correct information that comes with the payment that will help you to reconcile the balls and know, hey, are you making money or are you losing money, right? So payment is really mission critical to ensure the company has adequate funds to keep the lights on and also to support them to grow further. So that's where I find my current interest is really to help my clients to have the easiest, fastest, and most helpful payment mechanism in their day-to-day.
Yeah, interesting that you talk about payments, because it's an industry that's moving very quickly. And also in Asia, what we are also seeing is that there's a lot of cross-border payments. For instance, now being here in Singapore, I can go to a country like Indonesia and still use the QR code to make payment based on my banking solution. What are some of the trends that you might have observed in terms of payments and how cross-border payments are shaping up in the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. Payment is interesting, right? And I think when you think about cross-border, which I may touch on later, but learning from different industries is fascinating. Because I remember when I first started my first job as a management consulting back then is .com 1.0. And I was in China looking at, wow, all the dot-com companies in the U.S. and learn the case study. Can we have the same pet.com in China, et cetera, et cetera, or yahoo.com in China, right? But nowadays, as you know, as you mentioned, right, like we look back, you know, can North America learn something from Asia in terms of the payment adoption and innovation? Part of it has to do with, you know, for some country, because of the payment infrastructure, they completely leapfrog to the next generation, right? And for some countries that have more developed payment infrastructure, I would say during the 70s and 80s, that actually has been a barrier for them to quickly leapfrog to the next gen payment solution to have homogeneous or harmonized payment across region and across border. So I think the upcoming trend, which has been talked about for a long time, is still about real-time payment. How can we make payment faster, right? Especially when you got the cross-border payment, it's not that even today. And then also, I touched on earlier, with the useful information that comes with payment, right? Imagine if you are a manufacturer, you're gonna pay your vendor, the vendor that provide you raw material, could have sent you free invoices. Hey, guess what? I want to cut a check. We use check a lot in North America to pay two of the free invoices. Or I want to take advantage of the discount of invoice number one, but I want to pay half of the invoice number two. So all of those, how do you make sure the payment travel with the information? So at the end of the vendor, they know how to reconcile. Oh, you're only paying one invoice and second invoice half of it. So I still need to follow up the half of the second invoice and the third invoice. Imagine that's only for one vendor. If you have 100 vendors, right? So that gets complex. So I think the payment information is another trend that will become more and more important. And hopefully, with a lot of the new ISO standard, it will make it more homogeneous across country.
And turning back time a little bit, you were talking about previously you were doing a couple of M&A, particularly we understand that during your tenure at China Unicom, you played quite a pivotal role in terms of international acquisitions, including that of the Asia Global Crossing. Could you walk us through how was that experience and how was it acquiring a foreign entity, especially back in the days?
Yeah, back in the days, and when I was there, it was part of China NetCom, and then that China NetCom get acquired by China Unicom. So it's one of the first cross-border acquisition by a Chinese company of a foreign entity, and it's also in critical industry, right? Telecom industry. So there's definitely a lot of complexity in it, and also that acquisition is done the acquiree is in the process of bankruptcy procedure, right? So all of these add to the dynamics of cultural element. It's a different regulatory regime and approval process that we have to go through, or even like language, right? Obviously a lot of the document of the company that we're trying to acquire is English, and then when we present the key findings to our internal approval, it has to be in Chinese, right? So all of these add to the element, as well as that acquisition involve north of maybe 300 internal external professionals, right? We work with all the accounting firm, banker, lawyer, consultant, to help throughout the due diligence. So managing that process, as well as people speaking different language in different location, US, Hong Kong, China, time zone, and also sometimes like how people communicate certain things, right? Like, how they agree, how they disagree. Different culture may say it differently, as well as touch on the internal approval process. How many layers you have to socialize could be very different from, a Chinese company versus a foreign entity. And it has to make it transparent to the other party to a certain extent so that people know what to expect and know what are the milestones that we continue to hit. So I think throughout that experience, obviously, that stimulate my interest to pursue a career in M&A later in my career, but also give me the first sense of how to manage any cross-border or simply put, leading a team from very diverse background, right? Either geography or cultural language, or even today, where most of my work is focusing in Canada, but I'm still leading people from very diverse culture because we're, Canada is an immigrant country, right? So I think that experience back in the day is still very much applicable. And the bottom of it is when you are leading and working with a team from very different background, always think about what is an in for them. How do I get them buy-in? I think that ultimately is the most important point, whether it's different culture or different opinion or different line of business.
That's really quite interesting. I think right now, Recently, you have been awarded the RBC Global Citizen winner and also have been spending quite a bit of time orchestrating cross business, cross border, cross geography type projects in your current or maybe in your previous role, but in the same company. How were some of the learnings that you had back then, especially I would assume since it was the first time a Chinese entity is purchasing a foreign entity, there was no such thing as a playbook that you could refer to. What were some of the learnings that you took away from that and continue to apply to what you're doing right now?
Yeah, so a couple of things, right? One is it's important to invest the time to build the trust, right? Whether it's the counterpart or the professional firms that you're gonna work with, right? And different culture and different geography will add the time required to invest to build that relationship, but it's important. And the second thing is, as I mentioned, I think the what is it in for the other party is important, whether it's negotiation, whether it's getting their buy-in, because we come from so different background, right? So how we look at a deal could be very different from what our management in China versus the professional that are advising us based in Hong Kong, right? I think the third thing is, it's universally true. I think being able to communicate the clear why important for us, at least internally, to get the approval, because as I mentioned, it's the first one of the first type of this cross-border deal. So there's a lot of focus on scrutiny, right? What could go wrong? So for us to compare to deliver a compelling value proposition, why that cross-border transaction makes sense as part of the longer term strategy, and why this money and why this time, right? So I think that's the key to success, to build the credibility within our own regulatory or approval gatekeeper, so that they know, okay, even though there's no playbook, but there is compelling reason, you have done your proper due diligence, you have leveraged all of these professional firms, you are clear about what are you getting and how you're going to integrate the company you acquire to fit your future strategy.
I love that. I love that. So we briefly touched around how you had started your career in Asia, Hong Kong, China, and then now moving to the US and as well as Canada. What were some of your, how was the transition for you moving from one region to another? What prompted you to make that shift and move into another region?
Yeah, so in my career or life, I have uprooted myself a couple of times. I went to the States to study two times, and then went back to Hong Kong, start my career, and then went to China. And after my MBA, I may mention earlier, because of personal reason, I came to Canada without knowing anyone, right? So it's really restart my life again. So I'd say what triggered for me to move around or move to different region, as you can see, some of those motivated by opportunity, right? When I went to China or when I went to the States for study, and some are because of circumstances, personal reason. I didn't know anything about Canada, and I only know my husband, one person. And it was tough at the beginning because I already have a few years of experience back then, so I an expectation, okay, it shouldn't be too hard to find a job in Canada because I have all the relevant experience. I remember I sent out like 500 resume, and I didn't hear back from many. And for those I heard back, like interview with a few companies, and the common question they have is always, oh, you don't have a Canadian experience. I think we Canadian talk about it as a joke because it's still happening, right? People ask about the Canadian experience, but then I say, well, I have experience in the two largest economies of the world. Why wouldn't it be relevant? So what I learned is really upon the individual, I guess the immigrant or the newcomer, to try to tell your story. You cannot expect people understand what is China NetCom, what is China Unicom, or I graduate from Chinese university, accounting degree, which is the most difficult faculty to get in at that time. You have to make it relevant and be able to translate, oh, okay, China NetCom is equivalent to Bell Telecom in Canada, but X time larger, right? So being effective in telling the story is important. And very cliche, making network is important because I cannot expect to show up with a Stanford MBA, you're gonna hire me. It doesn't happen that way when you move to a new country. You gotta, find your network and talk to people to really understand what they're looking for. And showing up is half of the battle. I think it's really true, right? When I was looking for a job, I do try to rebuild my network. It take a lot of effort, but now it's a multiplier, right? And after a few years, you start to have your own network in Canada, and then it get easier. So I think that apply no matter when you move to any new country, right? Yes, you can leverage what you have, but you really have to be deliberate on building your network and telling your story.
Building on how you built the network, moving to a new country, what do you have any tips for people who are moving to a new country? What are some of the ways they can start building the network or at least form the initial circle, to continue building from there?
I remember at that time I Googled what are the 50 ways to build network, right? So there's some obvious choice. If you have a CFA or CA destination, go join those local chapter, right? Or if your university have a lot of overseas alumni, right? So see if there's a student alumni organization in the city that you're moving to. And then start to explore locally because, yes, joining those alumni network is good because you have something in common with those people. But the most important thing is you have to find, break in the local network. That's where you can really break into the local professional world, right? So, I mean, here, like I joined, there's women in capital market in Canada. I'm sure every country has its equivalent, right? So I think you just really try to find different aspect of yourself, right? Okay, you're women, try to find a women organization. Your interest in, I don't know, climate change. Okay, try to find those that resonate with you, right? At least find one element that is in common, right? And I always, at the beginning of my time in Canada, I try to go to a lot of networking event, and I always try to go to with one friend who is very much extrovert, right? And so can help me to meet other people. And also have a rule for myself and try to make it fun as a little game that I play with myself. It's every time when I go networking, I have a stack of cards, right? I have to give out 50 cards or receive 50 cards before I call it quit, right? Because I'm an introvert like many people. I get tired after a while at the networking event. But just to do it as a muscle training, as a discipline. So I almost forced myself to do it. So after a while, you kind of get used to it, right? And not all the 50 cars are useful, but at least you're getting yourself into the habit to put yourself out there to meet people.
Yeah, I think that's something I can learn myself as well as an introvert. Kind of reaching out is always saying that first hello. It's always the tricky part, but once you get into the conversation, then it becomes much easier. Actually,
Absolutely.
reflecting back on your move to the US and also the North, basically the North American region, and the kind of professional experiences and roles that you have taken up, then how would you say the move and having moved from one region to another has led to the different types of roles or projects that you have taken on today?
Yeah, so I will say a couple of things that I learned from that experience and build the track record, right? For sure, number one, you are very agile. You can pick up luggage to luggage and go to a new place to start again, right? So that will really set you up if there's any out of state or out of province opportunity, you can do it. And then the second thing is resilience, right? How many people can tell you that, hey, with good experience, I get 500 rejection, but I keep going, right? And I think that's common among the immigrant, and sometimes people don't pay attention to that kind of resilience. Right, because as you progress in your career, a lot of project that you do, it not all the time will line up smoothly, right? So the kind of resilience you have go through in your personal life to uproot yourself and settle into a new country, that will help you to tackle any new project and new challenges as well. And then obviously, as you go through the career, that may be opportunity because of, let's say, the language that you know, in addition to English, or the heritage you bring that may make you more suitable or more competitive when dealing with certain client segment, right? For example, every bank here have a newcomer team that focus on serving the newcomer, right? So, and they do tend to look for professional that are newcomer themselves, so they can relate better with the client that they want to serve.
That's very amazing. And reflecting on your journey, taking that brave first step, moving to a foreign country, what I would love to congratulate you on is you have been recognized as a key influence in the market, especially within the Asian community in Toronto. And that must have been quite a feat, given that you've been moving to a different country, and you mentioned you're an introvert yourself. So that must have taken a lot of hard work and also grit and resilience from yourself. Can you share with us how you are currently engaging with the community, and also your views around the cultural sensitivity that transcends to cross-border business operations?
Absolutely. And I would say the involvement in the community, it just come natural, right? Because as I mentioned, when I first come to Canada, it took me a while to find my footing in this new country. And the sense of belonging, I actually find it quite helpful when I start volunteering, spending time and fundraising for some of the not-for-profit organization, because they are serving a lot of the stakeholders, just like myself, immigrant. So I find my voice is actually quite valid for those organizations. So through working with them, I find my purpose in this new country, which to me is very important. And again, the sense of belonging. So nowadays, I'm spending more time on sitting on board for different not-for-profit organizations. For example, I sit on the board for an organization that called eHome, that is senior housing for seniors from Asian background, right? So if you think about it, we all love to have our home food, right? Like Singaporean food, Chinese food every now and then. And then when a senior retire and get old and live in senior housing, how nice it is to have cultural relevant meals or activities, right? So I sit on the board because I really believe in their vision. And some of my family members have lived in those senior housing as well and benefit from it, right? I also sit on the board for Toronto Zoo, which is one of the largest zoo in Canada. And I particularly interest in seeing how immigrant like myself can enjoy and learn more about animal with their kids at the Toronto Zoo. How can we attract more new immigrant to enjoy the zoo? Because many of them, maybe like myself, came from a city that don't have that kind of world-class zoo, right? So right now for me, I try to spend more time as board of director, I try to focus on causes that I can resonate well, either from an immigrant angle, or I'm particularly interested in either youth empowerment, education, or healthcare space, which I think are two very important pillar to have strong society for better sustainable future.
Yeah, and interesting that you mentioned about students and education. You have also funded a scholarship with the Ted Rogers School of Management in Toronto Metropolitan University, directly impacting international students. What in for that particular cause that you're championing, what kind of motivation did you have that inspired you to decide to fund the scholarship?
Thanks for asking that. And this is one of the proudest things that I have accomplished last year. As I think about, volunteering and serving the community, I have put in my effort, my brain power, and I've always been thinking about how can I make it more purposeful. Do I need to wait until I retire, or do I need to wait until I leave the world to do something like that? And I think, well, actually, no, I don't need to wait until that moment. I can do it now. The motivation is really thinking about my international student experience, which is, by the way, fantastic, great learning. But there's also, like any international student, homesick, feeling you're on your own, even though I learn independence from that. But, the sense of, do I belong to this country is really strong. And by sending this scholarship, I mean, obviously, it's some financial support to help out some of the students that they need. But also, I want to give them the sense of belonging, right? Because the international learning experience is one of the best for most people. They look back, right? The kind of learning, developing cultural sensitivity, and as I mentioned, like resilient independence, these are very useful for their later life. And I just want to do a little bit so that they feel more enjoyment when they're going through that experience, and they feel someone is, looking out for them. And also, tell the school that in addition to providing that scholarship, I also want to meet with the student and have a chat, right? Or a mentoring session. So that's what I feel I can already do, with my resources, either financial or my experience, in a very way.
And building on that as a student living abroad, what are some of the challenges that you often see or in based on your mentoring session, some of the things that they face, and how would you advise them to overcome that?
Yeah, a couple of things, as I mentioned, maybe using my own, right? I spent a year at Columbia University as an exchange student in New York, right? Manhattan, fantastic, great experience. But I was taking a lot of political science courses, like just, years. And, language was a challenge. It's a lot of writing assignment that, writing and reading that really, take me a long time to catch up, and also not knowing anyone to ask for help, right? And as I said, like at some point during that year, I feel living in a big city like Manhattan and not knowing anyone, I started to feel homesick, especially when the winter come, when it started to snow, right? So I'm sure like, these are all common experiences that international students will feel. what I will advise is, I think just think of that experience, as I said, is how you build resilience,
Yes.
right? And look at the challenges as temporary, and knowing that because you were brave enough to make that decision to go to a new country, you have enough courage and ability to overcome those transition challenges that you were facing. And I will say, those experiences, when you look back and when you start working, it will be very relevant. To add to that, obviously, the global perspective that you can read about it, but to really experience it, you have to be in that environment and working in a group project with your classmates from very different background, joining the student club, and then to communicate. And yes, I spoke English when I was studying in Hong Kong, but it's not the same, right? You learn about the nuances, how you can present in certain way when I was living studying in North America, and let alone the expanded network. These days, a lot of the jobs require a network that go very broad, right? And these days I still, from time to time through LinkedIn or through WeChat and WhatsApp, reach out to my friends in different country. Hey, I'm looking at XYZ company. What do you think? Do you have any resources, right? So those are the benefits, as well as independence, as I mentioned, right? You're gonna solve the problem, even to find doctor, or that could be the first time someone living away from home, right? So okay, how do you do laundry, cook, and then being able to survive on your own.
And you know
What?
the conversations that we have had so far, one of the things that really inspire me is the fact that you are very willing and you want to give back to the community and causes that you feel very strongly and strongly for and you're championing. And what I would love to touch on and also congratulate you on is being recognized as the Mentor of the Year. And that is a significant achievement. I would love to know, how has mentorship or how important has mentorship played a role in your personal journey? And how do you continue to either seek out mentors or mentees who are facing similar journeys or maybe different journeys as yourself and continue to give them advice and be a sounding board for individuals out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll say mentorship is always important for everyone's career journey, right? We all need someone to sometimes help us to see what we cannot see about our potential or the blind spot we have, or just open up our horizon, right? I'll say particularly important is when you got to change, make some big transition, either like myself, making movers across country or across industry, right? There's a lot of learning I can get from mentor. For example, when I moved from US to Canada, a previous colleague of mine helped me to pass around the resume, and through a couple of people passing down my resume, I get my first job, right? So, even though that colleague is not necessarily my mentor, but she's willing to lend her network to me to help me find my first job. And when I move from strategy to sales, which is a big shift, I also go to my mentor and ask about, hey, I've been doing well in strategy. I enjoy the intellectual challenge. I can always learn something new if I stay on in strategy. What do you think? But I'm always curious about sales, P&L. And with his advice, I jumped to sales. Because when someone give you the belief and opportunity to try something new, why not, right? So I definitely feel mentors has helped me a lot, in terms of, as I say, like confirming some of my belief or challenging some of my thinking, right? When I make those big decisions. And on top of that, obviously, if it makes sense, it opens doors to some of the network that I want to build. So right now, what I'm doing is I continue to seek out mentors and mentees. Recently, I started a Asian professionals network, and in the company that I work in, I think is really creating the platform for like-minded individuals that with Asian heritage. Now there's a safe space for them to share their experience, to help each other, to elevate and advocate, and also help them to find mentors. And personally, I mentor a lot of people in the organization or outside the organization. Some of them have similar background, right? Like Asian women or minority women or new immigrant. And I always feel by sharing my own experience, some of the setback that I have, I hope I can help someone to make it faster for them, right? Or elevate one each other. So I would say yes, mentorship is important, and it takes time to craft that relationship. It's not transactional. You always treat it as a, it's not as a friend, but it's a relationship that you want to build on. You want to make sure it's a win-win relationship, right? One thing people should be mindful is, don't go to someone to ask, oh, can you give me a job? Oh, can you introduce me to 10 other people, right? Like, think about what you will ask a friend to do and what you will do to a friend, right? Ask your mentor, what do you care about? What's important to you? How can I be helpful? Think about reciprocal. So that's the key success factor for maintaining a strong mentor-mentee relationship, as well as keeping your mentor in the loop, right? A lot of times people think about it as transactional. Oh, I get my next job. Now, goodbye, mentor. I don't need to be in touch with you for a long period of time until next time I want to find a new job, right? So that again is not relationship building, but it's transactional, and it's not about what mentoring should be.
Yeah, it's very important. I used to also be a management consultant at Bain, and then being investing in mentoring relationships, and also even until today that I've left for a while, continuing to keep them updated. I think you have pointed it absolutely right in terms of building relationships. And I think that doesn't just apply to mentorship, but also in any relationship that you're building. We alluded to it earlier when you're talking about working together with your clients, working together with a diverse group of people, understanding what's in it for them. I think that's very important. And rounding out to the last question, now that we are kind of at the start of 2024, what are you most excited about personally and professionally, and maybe from an industry perspective this year?
Yes, yeah, so there are a few trends that I'm seeing in the financial industry world that I'm really excited. Well, first of all, I would be remiss if I don't talk about AI. Personally, I love ChatGPT and other apps that are underpinned by that technology. I use it every day. There's always people make fun of me, hey, human is always better than robot. Yes, it is. I think it's important for us to really know the power of AI or generative AI and see how it can help organization or individual, you and me, to be more productive so that now you can prioritize your time for better things, right? For example, I love playing piano. Okay, that's one thing I want to keep doing more to remind why human are human. But for other stuff that can leverage AI or generative AI, let's leverage it and really learn the power and stay on top of it. And of course, the whole discussion of AI, the governance framework, right? Security and all of those need to be discussed in conjunction with exploring the opportunity. Another big trend, it's not new trend, right? Sustainable financing. I think talk about it for many years, but I think these few years I'm really seeing a lot of momentum, right, from financial industry or from other blue chip corporation that looking at ESG as a consideration on how they invest or how they lend. or how they want to choose their vendor, right? For example, I know organization like Walmart and P&G, they require their supplier to comply with the ESG governance framework, right? So that will play a full circle of what consumer has been focusing for quite some time. But now with the large corporation are playing a part that will really drive more material results. So that is what I'm quite excited about. I think we all need to learn about what does that mean to reduce carbon footprint, and what are the key trend of ESG in different industry, right? Like in agriculture, like in real estate, what can we do as organization or as individual? And the innovation or technology come with that. And then there are other trends like cybersecurity, fraud risk management is very important. In the financial industry, I know fraud laws these days globally can be hundreds of billions of dollars. And it's not a question of if, it's a question of when, right? So, and when you talk about innovation, this is the area that have a lot of innovation, no matter how fast the technology change, right? The bad actor it seems to always be ahead of the curve, right? From financial industry, like we know, there's accounts takeover, identity theft, credit card fraud, business email compromise, phishing attack, social engineering, you name it. So I think we all organizations have to continue to invest to be bulletproof, right? And as well as using how do you use data analytics or algorithm to prevent or broad some of the fraud. And that is not a once and done because as I see in the bank, the bad actor they learn very quickly, right? And it's just something that we have to continue to invest in the data side, in the governance side, in the protection side, as well as sometimes the fraud really, the weakest link is really from within. So the employee education in any organization is important because the bad actor will go to where you have the weakest link and break through it. So these are the trends that I'm seeing, and I'm excited to personally learn more and see from different part of the world what is leading ahead that we can learn from each other.
And I think it's very important just to understand like what could be the leading technology and apply it back to what we are doing wherever we might be. And we definitely have a lot to learn from each other. Thank you so much again, Rebecca, for joining me for a very inspiring morning for me and evening for you. And it has been absolutely lovely to hear your experiences and also see how you're so open-minded in terms of understanding and always learning and also embracing resilience and grit in every decision and move that you're making. And there's so much to learn from you and very, very happy and thankful for you to join us in today's episode.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you for listening to Business Beyond Borders. If you have any feedback or thoughts, do write in to us at support@bluen.com. Click to follow to tune into the next episode. See you again soon.